The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start with the cover story in the Triangle Business Journal. Crunching numbers. Can the Triangle really land Amazon HQ2? And this article is written by Dane Huffman. Numbers matter at Amazon, where founder Jeff Bezos has even asked job candidates their SAT scores. And in the chase for Amazon's second headquarters, it's clear from Amazon's first request for proposals that key numbers such as taxes, real estate, and government incentives will be weighed carefully by the company. The Triangle is one of 20 sites with a shot at the company's second headquarters and the potential for 50,000 jobs that come with it, and that leaves local officials eager to see how Amazon will proceed and how the Triangle will measure up. "We just need to get started. We just don't know what they want," says Ryan Combs, executive director of the Research Triangle Regional Partnership. The plan, Combs and his cohort say, is for officials, executives, and developers to gather in front of a whiteboard and talk out how to showcase the Triangle. "How we move forward through the next steps and what our response as a region is will be driven largely by the feedback we get from the company," says Adrian Cole, CEO of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. "We'll really be responsive to what the company is saying they need to understand so that they can continue to sort of fine-tune and hone in on Raleigh." While Amazon hadn't yet outlined the scope of what it's looking for in Phase 2, clues can be found in what the e-tailer told Charlotte. Charlotte, like Raleigh, was one of the metros responding to Amazon's initial request for proposals in 2017, but it didn't stack up in terms of talent, a review of Amazon's response shows. Amazon told Charlotte the company evaluated metros on 34 metrics. There's that focus on numbers again. And its tech talent pool is lacking compared to other markets. "It always comes down to talent," says Tony Copeland, North Carolina Commerce Secretary. "Talent and numbers." Here's a companion article also written by Dane Huffman. The headline, "North Carolina tax rate looks favorable in Amazon HQ2 bid. Jeff Bezos was weighing tax implications right from the beginning of Amazon. In 1994, Bezos couldn't get the Wall Street hedge fund where he worked excited about selling books online. So he left New York City and moved to Seattle, a market where he had no significant connections. But Bezos, so frugal he made desks from Home Depot doors, knew the state of Washington had favorable tax laws for online retailers and tech talent. 2 decades later, Amazon still frames decisions around the same principles. The company is ruthless about reducing costs, which means it will closely eye the tax and regulatory implications for candidates for its second headquarters. Scott Drencard, Director of State Projects for the State Foundation of Washington, says North Carolina's current corporate tax rate of 3%, which drops to 2.5% next year, is an advantage. According to the Tax Foundation, North Carolina's rate is the lowest among the 44 states with a corporate tax. North Carolina's corporate tax rate has dropped from 6.9% in 2013, which Drencard says was the highest in the Southeast. There are going to be a lot of states that have offered very targeted incentives to try and lower their taxes and make their taxes competitive, Drencard says. One of the great things about North Carolina is the standard bread-and-butter tax system is already quite competitive. In May, Site Selection magazine awarded North Carolina the Prosperity Cup for being favorable to business. Among the 10 factors used to rank the states was the Tax Foundation survey. Raleigh attorney Bruce Thompson of Parker Poe, who has worked with clients in this field, says the tax rate is one of a number of things a company such as Amazon will consider. "They're going to have a duty to their shareholders to look at the ultimate cost of doing business in the states," he says. "That can include the cost of power, income taxes on workers, and other factors such as the cost of infrastructure. And a change to North Carolina's corporate tax structure that has received little attention could play a significant factor." According to accountants Larry Hamilton and Brooks Malone of Raleigh's Hughes, Pittman, and Gupton, starting January 1, 2018, the state now decides how much of a corporation's income is subject to state tax based on revenue from sales only in North Carolina. Previously, the state had apportioned that total based on a formula that included property, payroll, and sales across the company. not just its North Carolina operations. For a multinational corporation, that change is enormous, one so critical that Hamilton and Malone suggested landing Amazon would be difficult without it. What North Carolina has done is they have gradually shifted to a single apportionment factor. In North Carolina in 2018, the only factor is based on your sales, Hamilton says. So a company locating in North Carolina, Hamilton says, is no longer penalized because of major operations elsewhere. They will just pay tax in North Carolina based on the ratio of their sales in North Carolina, he adds. That change, says Malone, the leader of the firm's technology practice, has major implications for Amazon. They will pay a lot less tax, he says. And now we turn to an article by Lauren K. Onasorge on the same topic. The headline, Could the Triangle's Tech Talent Support Amazon HQ2 Needs? Should Amazon bring a 50,000-job headquarters to the Raleigh region, the impact would be immense. Consider that SAS Institute, with its sprawling headquarters in Cary, has just 5,600 employees here. IBM, at its peak, had about 10,000 in Research Triangle Park, and those are just two of the technology firms that would be competing for talent alongside the Seattle behemoth. While the presence of those tech titans is part of why Daniel Ives, an analyst of GBH Insights, puts Raleigh as his number two pick for the project behind Atlanta, it's clear that another major player would further constrain the talent pool. Cooperation from the universities, already the region's biggest talent driver, would be essential in luring the project, Secretary of Commerce Tony Copeland says. Look at the technology talent coming out of Duke, NC State University, UNC Chapel Hill, and NC Central, he says, adding that Wake Tech also contributes graduates who could supply Amazon with employees. Even so, the numbers show technology companies are already creating a competitive environment for that talent even without Amazon. Numbers just released from the North Carolina Technology Association show 5,853 job openings in technology in the Raleigh Metro in December alone, up 0.5% from the year prior. The data show that statewide, the search for talent was particularly fierce for software developers, computer systems analysts, and computer user support specialists, with more than 11,000 openings for each role. The higher up the skill chain, the thinner the talent pool, and thus more difficult to fill positions, says NCTA CEO Brooks Rayford, noting that employers are already depending on a wide range of partnerships with training organizations and universities to fill their openings. And some local managers of large Triangle Technology operations agree. Just a couple of months ago, Jeff Lang, Vice President and General Manager of MetLife Global Technology and Operations, said recruiting talent is an issue. Part of the problem is we steal from each other, Lang said, referring to companies such as Credit Suisse and IBM. He spoke at an event hosted by Triangle Business Journal in November. The universities are good, but that doesn't fill the pool. They're just not enough people with the skills we need to grow. And the unfortunate thing is we do steal from each other, and that's not a healthy way for this geography. Copeland envisions training incentives as part of a package offered to Amazon, but even so, the region will need to recruit outside the triangle to fill Amazon's needs, which is why the area's high livability rankings are an important selling point. Copeland points to the region's ability to attract other major tech employers as proof that the business community believes in its talent pool. Infosys, for example, tapped Raleigh last year for a 2,000-job tech hub. And Ravi Kumar, the Indian IT firm's president and deputy chief operating officer, has said repeatedly that companies like his can't just rely on resumes. Infosys fills its positions through what he refers to as last-mile training programs. It doesn't count on a region to provide workers. We create the talent, he said last year. And it's likely that to succeed in the triangle, Amazon would have to take on that same type of ownership in its own workforce. Amid Amazon HQ2 hunt, here's where Durham Orange Light Rail stands. This is an article written by Lauren K. Onasorge. While it's still years away from construction and still subject to federal funding decisions, the Durham Orange Light Rail project is a major priority for regional transit agency Go Triangle in 2018. That's according to Jeff Mann, Go Triangle's general manager, speaking a week after Amazon named the Triangle as a finalist for its HQ2. The e-commerce giant has listed mass transit accessibility as a priority in its site selection. Mann says he's had several conversations with officials about the company over the past week. "We look forward to working with partners in the region," he says, "but regardless of what the Seattle firm decides to do, he sees light rail making a difference in Triangle traffic." Last summer, the feds gave Go Triangle permission to enter into the engineering phase, a $100 million effort that takes the project from 30% to a final design. And as design work continues, Mann says plans are also progressing for what officials call the ROMF, or ROMF, the Rail Operations and Maintenance Facility. Go Triangle has made offers to all 9 property owners whose 15 parcels make up the ROMF space that will not only accommodate staff, but also have the space to store, service, and maintain up to 26 light rail vehicles. Mann says those negotiations with landowners are progressing, but declined to comment further about the process. In Go Triangle's monthly update memo to Orange County commissioners last week, the agency told officials that if settlements aren't reached, Go Triangle will request authorization from the board to acquire any remaining parcels by eminent domain. The facility is targeted to start construction in 2019. But it's just one piece of the expansive light rail plan for the region. Elected officials in both Durham and Orange counties added yet another element in December, voting to add a station in downtown Durham between Blackwell and Mangum Streets. That change is being submitted to the FTA for reevaluation as part of the engineering phase, as it wasn't on the original paperwork. Mann says it's simply an added component and hasn't contributed to any delays. According to the update memo, the project is still on track to finish 50% of the design work by March. Stakeholders, including Durham, Chapel Hill, and the North Carolina Department of Transportation, will formally review the plans and provide comments to Go Triangle. The project is expected to complete 75% of the design phase this fall and finish in 2019. That's when Go Triangle hopes to obtain the full federal funding agreement for the project so that construction can get started. Go Triangle continues to count on the Federal Transit Administration following through with its end of the deal. The FTA's approval for pre-award authority is not a guarantee that the project will get the more than $1.2 billion in capital investment grants that account for more than half of the light rail costs, though officials have said repeatedly they believe the feds will recognize the project's importance. The 17.7-mile system is projected to provide more than 26,000 trips per day to residents and commuters in Durham and Chapel Hill when it's complete. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. And the headline that starts it off, Relias says to millennials, "Hey guys, we're hiring." For Cary-based Relias, led by Triangle Business Journal's 2017 Business Person of the Year, Jim Triandaflu, millennial talent is a critical part of its rapid growth. The company, focused on training, analytics, and assessments for the healthcare field, is in the middle of a 450-job expansion in North Carolina and has continued to grow through acquisitions, completing 13 over the last 5 years. According to Tina Krebs, Vice President of People and Organizational Development at Relias, upward of 50% of the company's employees are millennials. Triandaflu says Relias targets the millennial population. Research shows that millennials value variety, training, and making a difference in their work. Moving folks around, I think, is really useful to attract millennials, just giving them that variety, and then talking about the broader purpose of what your business does, he says. Relias, which is highly selective in its hiring, is looking for a crop of talent keen on a fast-paced and high-energy environment as well as change. Last year, Relias hired 1.6% of the resumes it received, Triandaflu said, but he added, "We always want more, faster." New Canes owner visits real estate crowd. Developers and real estate professionals at the PNC Arena conference got an unexpected visit from the man now preoccupied with filling the stadium. Thomas Dundon, the new majority owner of the Carolina Hurricanes, briefly took the stage at NAI Carol Atlantic Realty's 33rd Annual Triangle Commercial Real Estate Conference. "I think there's more of you here than we had Sunday night," Dundon quipped to the 1,600-person crowd, a comment that elicited laughter. Dundon, who acquired a majority stake in the team earlier this month, didn't have much to say about real estate, but he did stress his desire to work with those in the room, which included leaders in business and government. "We want to get you engaged with the team and get the team engaged in the community," Dundon said. "We're putting in a lot of work, and hopefully you'll see some results soon." He also confirmed that he does not have plans to relocate his family to Raleigh, a question that he says many people have been asking him. That said, Dundon said he is trying to convince his son to attend college in the Triangle. Holtz hold party with a purpose at NC State. On January 21, if you were not inside NC State University's Reynolds Coliseum facility during the New England Patriots Jacksonville Jaguars NFL playoff game, you missed out on a big party with some ex-NFL players who were there for a worthy cause. Former Wolfpack football stars Torrey and Terrence Holt hosted their fifth annual playoff party at the NCSU facility. While tickets were not cheap, the Holt brothers are quite clear about their mission. They want to raise money to support children who have parents with cancer. As part of the festivities, the brothers offered Super Bowl tickets to a raffle winner and raised some $160,000. Some notable former pro players spotted by Biz include Detroit Lions defensive back Dre Bly, who played at UNC Chapel Hill, and wide receiver Anquan Boldin. And NCSU hoops legend Derek Wittenberg was seen mingling with the crowd. PNC's regional head, Jim Hansen, UNC Rex chief financial officer, Andrew Zukowski, and Trademark Properties' Billy Redman were among the executives there. Torrey Holt was 10 and Terrence 6 when their mother, Ojeda, was diagnosed with lymphoma. After she died, they committed to helping children with a parent with cancer. Apple executives have ties to North Carolina. Duke University's announcement that Apple CEO Tim Cook will speak at its commencement May 13 underscores the close relationship Apple's top executives have with the Triangle. While the Amazon news has dominated headlines here, Apple is also looking for a new campus, and Apple's top leaders are quite familiar with the market. Cook worked at IBM in the Triangle for 12 years and got his MBA from Duke in 1988. "From the first day I walked onto campus more than 30 years ago, Duke has been a source of inspiration and pride for me," Cook said in a statement about commencement. The Triangle roots of Apple Chief Operating Officer Jeff Williams are even deeper. He went to Sanderson High School of Raleigh and graduated from NC State University in 1985. Williams also has an MBA from Duke, finishing in 1991, and like Cook, worked at IBM early in his career, being with Big Blue from 1985 to 1998 before leaving for Apple. Williams is Cook's key lieutenant and was named COO in December 2015. Delta, still the leader as RDU sees record year. With 11.6 million passengers in 2017, Raleigh-Durham International Airport posted another record-crushing year. RDU saw a 5.6% increase in passenger traffic over 2016, with Delta Airlines once again the largest carrier with 30.8% of the market share. NC State University economist Michael Walden suspects the main mover behind the numbers is the region's economic growth, driven by more people moving here and regional job creation, he says. Still, to continue these trends, RDU will need to expand in flights and destinations, he says. Here's how the top three carriers stacked up in terms of just in-plane passengers in 2017. Delta, 1.8 million, American, 1.5 million, and Southwest, 1.2 million. And now we turn to A Better World, the headline on this week's column. Teachers in high-need areas get support. High-need public schools, those with a large percentage of students living in poverty, typically lose at least half their teachers every year, compared to a loss of 15% of teachers at the average U.S. public school. To help reduce teacher turnover, the Center for Teaching Quality in Carrboro has begun working on a pilot project with 12 high-need public schools in South Carolina to make it easier for excellent teachers to share their teaching strategies with colleagues. Not just in the U.S., but in the best-performing systems of education around the world, you will find very sophisticated systems of teacher development, says Barnett Berry, founder and CEO of the Center for Teaching Quality. We know that the systems that work the best create opportunities for teachers to develop and use their knowledge of children to solve their problems of practice. Founded in 1998, the center operates with an annual budget of $3 million and a staff of 15 employees, and is shifting its business strategy to at least double from 15% now the share of revenue it generates from fees for services, and to reduce from 85% now the share it gets from foundation grants. The center works with state education agencies, school districts, other nonprofits, businesses, and networks of schools to find ways to help good teachers become leaders in efforts to improve public schools. The center supports professional development of teachers that helps them measure their impact and share their knowledge with other teachers and administrators in virtual communities of practice and through systems of collective leadership, Barry says. Most teachers are very much siloed from each other, with very few opportunities for even our best teachers to share their expertise with their colleagues, he says. We have excellent teachers and excellent teaching going on, but it doesn't spread from classroom to classroom. Realigning education resources to support more professional development also is critical, Barry says. In Jefferson County, Kentucky, the center has worked with 30 effective teachers to create online study groups to share their teaching expertise with 1,500 other teachers in the school district, which includes 180 schools, 6,000 teachers, and 100,000 students. And 2 years ago, the center worked with teachers in 15 schools in the Daytona school system in Volusia County, Florida, to improve their own teaching practices and those of their colleagues. In just 1 year, Barry says, student achievement in those schools improved 10 percentage points. But metrics alone will not be enough to persuade elected officials, educators, or the public about the value of shifting resources, such as reorganizing the school day and making more time for teachers to lead to enable good teachers to teach one another, Barry says. Also critical, he says, is finding ways to help good teachers use technology and social media to raise awareness about their work and its impact on students. We're certainly cognizant of the mountain we're trying to climb, Barry says. We cannot do this alone. And turning to the reporter pages, we start with Lauren K. Onosorge and the headline on her first article, Precision Hawk raises $75 million, eyes billion-dollar exit, CEO says. Armed with $75 million in new financing, Raleigh's Precision Hawk is flush with cash and ready to execute on the bold ambitions of its new CEO. We have the opportunity to grow a multi-billion dollar, maybe even public company right here in Raleigh, says Michael Chasen, CEO since January 2017. The triangle is lacking when it comes to billion-dollar exits, he notes. I would love Precision Hawk to be that company. The latest financing raised from a large group of investors, including Third Point Ventures, Comcast Ventures, Senator Ventures Limited, Constellation Technology Ventures, and Syngenta Ventures, will help get it there, he explains. Precision Hawk was founded with initial investment dollars from Bob Young, co-founder of Red Hat. When the feds allowed companies to start deploying drones in certain circumstances back in 2016, Young equated it to flipping a switch. The company's pipeline increased 300%, but it couldn't fully capitalize on the opportunity without more cash, Chasen says. We just needed to be able to ramp up to go after this huge opportunity, he explains. One of the first things we did was say, okay, we need to raise some additional capital. So Chasen got to work. He estimates being on the road for 6 months straight to close the round, flying to New York, Florida, California, Seattle, and Russia to close the deal. Now the challenge is to execute, he says, and part of that involves hiring. Already the team has been ramping up at its Raleigh office. The plan is to hire an additional 100 employees in the next year in everything from engineering to computer programming. Michael Yang, managing director at Comcast Ventures, says Comcast has been researching and evaluating the drone market for several years, but Precision Hawk is its first investment in the space. It's waiting for a tipping point, he says, of the drone sector, and Precision Hawk is blazing the path. Katrin Burt, the UK-based managing director for another of those investors, Syngenta Ventures, says her company is always looking for non-obvious solutions to a variety of farming problems, and Precision Hawk stuck out. We think it's still a relatively nascent field, but that Precision Hawk really has the opportunity to own the space and create value for the growers, she says. Both Yang and Burt say seasoned leadership and Chasen helped secure their funding commitments. Chasen, prior to joining Precision Hawk in 2017, co-founded education technology firm Blackboard, taking it public and then private when a private equity firm bought it for $1.6 billion. His hire was a signal of Precision Hawk's growth ambitions, Yang says. "You're not going to attract talent like that if you're not going after big game," Yang says. The company has about 150 employees, including about 100 in Raleigh. In addition to new investors, existing backers such as Intel Capital, Millennium Technology Value Partners, DuPont Ventures, Verizon Ventures, a subsidiary of USAA, NTT Tokomo Ventures, Yamaha Motor, and Indiana University's Innovate Indiana Fund participated in the $75 million round. The funding brings Precision Hawk's total venture haul to $100 million, according to the company. Founding CEO exits Durham's Matty Energy. After 6 years, Tatiana Bergeson, the entrepreneur whose Duke University dorm room concoctions inspired beverage startup Matty Energy, is leaving the company she founded. The company announced early Tuesday that it is launching a search for a permanent replacement to scale the organization to its full potential. In the interim, investor and board member Lauren Whitehurst is taking on the CEO role. Bergeson, according to Matty's announcement, will move toward pursuing new opportunities outside the company. Bergeson couldn't immediately be reached to comment. Matty does not disclose annual revenue, but Inc. magazine stated the company's 2015 revenue topped $5.5 million. In an interview, Whitehurst says Bergeson is supportive of the plan. She really cares greatly about the future of the company. Whitehurst, who has been involved with the company in an advisory capacity for several years, says the transition comes out of a need to scale up. "There was just an understanding that we really needed to transition to someone who has a lot of experience," she says. "The company, the business, the product is so good, and Bergeson did a great job getting us started. Having someone seasoned in the role can get us there faster and with less risk." Whitehurst says the team has a big vision for the company's trajectory. "The plan is growth," she says. "The plan is to turn this from something that started in the Triangle to something that is a national brand." Over the next few days, the company will deploy an outside firm to search for a permanent leader. Under Bergeson's leadership, the firm inked partnerships with Whole Foods, Kroger, Costco, and others, and it won the coveted Google Demo Day title in 2015, securing an investment from AOL co-founder Steve Case in the process. Bergeson began Matty by brewing tea in her Duke University dorm room. Rave reviews from family and friends led her to incorporate her company in 2012. The company has a manufacturing plant in Clayton. Last year, Matty got another boost, closing $5 million in institutional funding. Pinnacle execs tout Raleigh's strategy following Bank of North Carolina merger. A shift in strategy has executives at Nashville, Tennessee-based Pinnacle Financial Partners excited about the bank's trajectory in Raleigh. On its latest earnings call, CEO Terry Turner told analysts the bank's growth would keep accelerating in Bank of North Carolina's legacy markets, Raleigh included. He expects to see the area's double-digit growth in commercial real estate to continue, but we expect to really augment that with building out the commercial and industrial platform, he says. Mark Carlton, Executive Vice President and North Carolina Eastern Region President for the bank, says that in the Triangle in particular, the strategy means a much more competitive institution. He calls 2017 a transition year for the bank as it started that shift toward more C&I business. In 2018, Pinnacle is ready to accelerate. Since the Pinnacle merger, the bank has hired 6 additional financial advisors in the Triangle region, including 3 in C&I, all part of its push in the market. "We're always going to remain in the commercial real estate finance market, but we're adding resources to increase our focus and our production in C&I lending," he says. "If you think about all the businesses that are located in the Triangle, from small to mid-sized company, that really is the sweet spot of lending, and we've always dabbled in it. But we feel like it's certainly a better way to grow your company to have a balanced approach." And as for the flurry of deals announced in 2017 starts to settle, it better prepares the bank for the competition that's building, he notes. When making its hiring decisions, and more are expected in 2018 across all areas, from C&I to wealth management, the bank is looking for banking veterans with at least 15 years' experience. By hiring established bankers that already have a following, it's further increasing its customer base, Carlton says. And Pinnacle grants its local markets autonomy, which he thinks the Triangle will find attractive. Most decisions can be made locally without the bureaucratic net that can complicate major transactions at big banks, he says. In the Triangle region alone, Pinnacle ended with about $900 million in loans and $450 million in deposits, he explains. That's double-digit growth in both loans and deposits, and that's during a transition year, he says. Imagine, perhaps, what it would have been if we weren't integrating the two companies. He points to a $450 million local loan pipeline going into 2018 with the potential to give it a good lift. According to Turner, the Carolina markets have another good thing going for them, and that's the economy. We had nice growth in the fourth quarter, Turner told analysts on the earnings call of the bank's newly acquired markets. I expect the growth to be better in 2018, but I don't see that primarily as a functional loan demand. A good part of the growth that we've enjoyed thus far, and I will project going forward, is really tied to the economic growth. Across its operation, the Nashville Bank reported $211.2 million in revenue for the quarter ended in December. Loans ended the year at $15.6 billion, with deposits at $16.5 billion. Overall, the bank's assets exceed $22 billion. And now we move to reporter Jennifer Henderson's page with the headline, Story Behind How the Triangle Lost Another Public HQ, This Time BioCryst. As Durham's BioCryst Pharmaceuticals, NASDAQ, BCRX, and Exton, Pennsylvania-based Adara Pharmaceuticals, NASDAQ, IDRA, announced an agreement to merge in an all-stock deal Monday with plans to headquarter the combined company in Exton and consolidate a research center in Birmingham, Alabama. Leaders from BioCryst say the transition will be gradual, with a legacy BioCryst program of critical importance over the next 2 years. Operations will transfer over time to Exton, says BioCryst CEO John Stonehouse, who will serve as a member of the combined company's board of directors. That transition will not be immediate. Our lead program, BCX7353, for the treatment of hereditary angioedema, is a critical asset for the merged company. We are in the process of starting a Phase 3 study, and if it is successful, we will file an NDA, new drug application, for approval, says Stonehouse. It is necessary that the team that has been part of that continue to drive that forward. The trial is expected to complete in the first half of 2019, says Stonehouse, with filing slated for the second half of next year and approval in 2020. With mergers of equals, it is inevitable that there is not a need for two of every position, says Robert Ingram, pharmaceutical executive and former CEO and chairman of GlaxoSmithKline. Ingram was named chairman of BioCryst board last year and will also lead the board of the combined company. But there has been commitment from both parties to make sure that we have continuity as we drive BCX7353 through the Phase 3 clinical trial to submission of the NDA and hopefully approval, he says. There is also the possibility that down the road, key staff from BioCryst may stay with the combined company and relocate to Pennsylvania, he says. And biopharmaceutical opportunities in the Triangle continue to grow, he says, and talent is always a premium. According to Stonehouse, BioCryst's current headcount is about 70 employees, with between 30 and 40 of those employees based locally. Aside from BCX7353, the combined company's pipeline will include, among other rare disease-focused product candidates, legacy Idera product IMO-2125, also at the Phase 3 stage of development for the treatment of a type of melanoma. Stonehouse says that it is likely that this drug will work in a number of solid tumor types, and even with the scale that we have with the combined company, going into all of these different types of cancer is a large task and resource demand. The idea of finding a partner in the immuno-oncology space was really attractive to us, he says of the merger. That really does fit into a macro strategy that is occurring with big pharma and big biotech, says Ingram, noting that larger companies are looking beyond their own research and development, particularly when it comes to the rare disease arena. While Stonehouse and Vincent Milano, Idera CEO, who will also serve as CEO of the combined company, began talking a couple years back, Stonehouse says plans for a merger started to firm up in the late summer and early fall of last year. I'm laser focused on getting the deal closed and then supporting Ingram and Milano and the board, says Stonehouse. That is as far as I can see right now. Durham Company acquires Colorado competitor. On the heels of a $30 million manufacturing expansion in Durham and Boulder, Colorado, contract development and manufacturing organization KBI Biopharma has completed its latest acquisition. KBI's most recent acquisition, that of Louisville, Colorado-based contract services organization Elion Labs, marks the fourth acquisition for KBI since February. Certainly, we will continue to grow, says Tim Kelly, president and CEO of KBI, adding that KBI's recent expansions have been fairly opportunistic. KBI has known about Elion since the company started back in 2015, he says, adding that KBI and Elion have been neighbors and competitors in Colorado. Elion was founded following biopharmaceutical giant Amgen's closure of operations in Colorado, and KBI also hired talent in the wake of the closure, says Kelly. Now the acquisition of Elion, including all of its 20 employees, will aid in bolstering KBI's cornerstone analytics capabilities at its locations in Colorado, along with Durham and Research Triangle Park, the Woodlands, Texas, and San Diego. North Carolina has really substantial analytics infrastructure and expertise at both sites, says Kelly. One of the reasons the deal was attractive to Elion, he says, was the ability to expand the scope of their service offerings to their clients through KBI's locations in North Carolina and elsewhere. KBI's acquisition of Elion closely follows a pair of acquisitions announced in June. At the time, KBI said that it had agreed to acquire the assets of Alliance Protein Laboratories based in San Diego, while parent company JSR Life Sciences said that it had agreed to acquire Switzerland's Solexis and integrate it into KBI's operations. In February, KBI said it had acquired the manufacturing and laboratory assets of Opexa Therapeutics in the Woodlands. As for the acquisition of Elion, co-founders John Gabrielson, Brent Kendrick, and Kelly Arthur will continue to oversee operations at the existing Colorado facility, according to KBI. Financial terms of the acquisition are not being disclosed. Whether the pace of KBI's expansion over the last 12 months will continue in 2018, Kelly's not sure just yet, but he says the company will stay active in looking for opportunities that it believes will benefit clients, shareholders, and employees. KBI employs about 650, with approximately 400 based in North Carolina. With new Carry HQ underway, Chiesi USA eyes growth. And that's Chiesi spelled C-H-I-E-S-I. With construction of its new headquarters overlooking Symphony Lake underway, Cary-based pharmaceutical company Chiesi USA has its sights set on more growth in 2018. The company's headcount has doubled over the last 3 years to 256 employees, including field-based sales representatives, and plans for the new headquarters are motivated by getting its roughly 120 corporate employees in Cary under one roof, says Josh Franklin, Senior Vice President of Marketing and Corporate Development of Chiesi USA. We are still expecting that we'll be moving into the new space in the fourth quarter of this year, he says. Moving forward, the company anticipates larger growth spurts around M&A activity. In addition, Chiesi USA's current strategic plan includes driving the growth of its portfolio of marketed products and projects in its development pipeline, Franklin says. While construction continues on the new headquarters, Chiesi USA is also looking to some of the interior design elements it believes will be critically important to its existing and expanding employee base. We're looking at more spaces for groups of people to work together in formal teams, but also to come together in a shared space in an informal way to share ideas and energy, Franklin says. That's a big part of the design work that is currently taking place. The company is also looking to incorporate elements to visually reflect some of the elements of the heritage of the company, where we've come from and where we aspire to go, he says. Back in 2014, Cary drug developer Cornerstone Therapeutics merged into Italy-based Chiesi Pharmaceutici. Chiesi's global revenue was roughly the equivalent of $1.7 billion in 2016, with U.S. revenue at approximately $275 million. Now we turn to reporter Ben Graham's pages with the first headline, Mixed-Use Community with Wegmans Passes Major Hurdle in Cary. A 2.5 million square foot community anchored by a new Wegmans has gained a crucial rezoning approval from the Cary Town Council, marking a significant step in the progress of a project that supporters say will reshape the eastern gateway into town. The council unanimously voted Thursday evening to change the land use rules for a 92-acre undeveloped parcel owned by the state along Cary Town Boulevard. With the approval in hand, Columbia Development of South Carolina will be able to build 1.2 million square feet of Class A office space, more than 900 luxury residences, two boutique hotels, and 440,000 square feet of specialty retail. With recent projected cost increases, the project is now expected to have an $850 million price tag. Cary is on the map, but this puts a big red dot on the map, Councilman Don France said at the meeting. The next step is for Columbia Development to bring forward specific development plans for the project called Fenton to the town and close on the sale of the property. The project is one of several high-profile developments that could soon change the face of the eastern gateway into Cary. Across the street, a new IKEA is planning to build its first triangle location at Cary Town Center. Tennessee-based CBL Properties also has submitted plans to redevelop the rest of the mall by building 60,000 square feet of office space and 800 housing units. The approval comes after more than 2 years of planning and months of discussions with Cary leaders and community members. In August, Columbia Development hosted a trip of a dozen Cary officials to Avalon, a development in Alpharetta, Georgia, that Columbia is using as a model for Fenton. Cary officials had told the firm to plan bigger to incorporate more commercial mixed-use buildings and spaces. The rezoning approved Thursday allows that to happen. The project falls within the new Eastern Cary Gateway Small Area Plan adopted a little more than a year ago. The plan recommends that the Fenton site have a mix of commercial uses up to 15 stories in height and also has guidelines for development at the Cary Town Center. This is an opportune time to build a project from the ground up, and we're thrilled to move forward with our plans to deliver cosmopolitan amenities to East Cary, stated Abbott Goodwin, partner at Columbia Development and Wake County resident. Whether running errands at lunchtime, meeting coworkers and friends at happy hour, or grabbing coffee on the way to the office, people want to work and spend time in vibrant, energized places. Fenton will exemplify this concept. Before construction can begin, Columbia Development has to finalize a development agreement with the town and gain approval for the Phase 1 plans. The development plan approval process will likely take place over the next year, says Russ Overton, deputy town manager. Elsewhere in the triangle, Columbia Development is responsible for the Costco-anchored Nichols Plaza project in Apex. The firm also built the Harris Teeter-anchored New Bern Marketplace in New Bern. Changes coming to North Hills Skyline. The North Hills Skyline is set to change in the next year, with construction on track to begin in the coming months for several office and residential towers. Work will start in the spring on a project called the Towers of North Hills. Kane Realty Corporation President Mike Smith writes in an email, the development includes a 575,000-square-foot residential tower that will front Six Forks Road and rise 32 stories, just shy of the tallest tower in downtown Raleigh, the 33-story PNC Plaza. The building will have 308 luxury apartments and 185 boutique hotel rooms. Next door will be a 20-story Class A office building totaling 650,000 square feet and sporting a conference center. Both are expected to open in mid-2020. The spring will also bring construction on a 33-acre parcel that Kane acquired along St. Albans Drive. Raleigh City Council approved an amendment to the North Hills East Master Plan last year to incorporate the property, clearing the way for new development. First up will be a residential project, Smith says, with groundbreaking expected in the spring. A site map for the parcel shows 4 residential buildings and 2 office buildings. The property also is being prepped to serve as an outdoor space for residents and workers. The area will also have an incredible park which connects to the greenway, Smith says. All throughout the site will be 10-foot-wide activity sidewalks that can be used for walking, jogging, and exercising. This area will highlight wellness and fitness. In the past year, Kane completed the 330,000-square-foot Midtown Plaza, which is now 95% leased, and has Allscripts and SunTrust as anchor tenants. Marriott's new upscale AC hotel also opened, as did the high-rise residential project called Park Central. And in general news, North Carolina regulators approve Atlantic Coast Pipeline. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. State regulators in North Carolina have given the Atlantic Coast Pipeline permission to move forward in 8 of its counties. The approval, issued Friday by the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, is contingent on certain conditions for testing and monitoring. As NCDEQ Secretary Michael Reagan cautioned in a prepared statement, it doesn't mean the state won't continue its due diligence. Our job doesn't end with the granting of the permit, but continues as we hold the company accountable to live up to its commitments, he stated. Our efforts have resulted in a carefully crafted permit that includes increased environmental protections while giving us the tools we need to continue close oversight of this project as it moves forward. Specifically, the state granted the project what's called a 401 water quality certification. ACP had first applied for it in May, with the state going back to the company on 5 occasions to request additional information. Contingencies include monitoring of stream and wetland restorations and requirements that ACP work in the dry as much as possible. All stream crossing construction activities must be conducted using best practices to divert water and limit potential sediment pollution in streams, NCDEQ specifies. Additionally, ACP must use a horizontal directional drill when crossing the Neuse River, document drilling fluids and additives used, conduct private well testing, submit to regular inspections, and undertake stormwater protections. ACP will also need to obtain an air quality permit for a compressor station in Northampton County in the northeastern part of the state. The project still needs general stormwater permits for Nash and Cumberland counties and approval of the erosion and sediment control plan for its northern segment. At the federal level, it also needs a water quality permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In a prepared statement, ACP commended NCDEQ staff for the years of hard work and careful study, and thank the public for the thoughtful and constructive input. Today's approval brings North Carolina one step closer to a growing economy, thousands of new jobs, and lower energy costs for consumers, the statement reads. With new infrastructure, the region will be able to attract manufacturers and other new industries and the good-paying jobs they bring. Economic developers were celebrating the news minutes after it was announced. Hopefully, we can proceed forward and begin to market the opportunity not just to our existing industries, but also companies considering the area, says Chris Johnson, Economic Development Director of Johnston County. But the project, a partnership between Duke Energy and Dominion Energy, had created controversy, particularly from landowners along the stretch, many of whom have refused to voluntarily sign over their properties. The companies are already pursuing permission for some of those parcels through eminent domain, and through specially obtained permission from the feds, they had started preliminary vegetation clearing. Project spokesman Aaron Ruby says about 80% of landowners have reached agreements with ACP, but declines to break it out by state. ACP and its partners are also putting $57.8 million into a new clean energy fund to be used for environmental mitigation initiatives, such as reducing the carbon footprint. Governor Roy Cooper, whose office has repeatedly ignored requests to outline his stance on the natural gas pipeline in the past, released a statement Friday on the fund. My goal for North Carolina is complete reliance on renewable energy, which builds a cleaner environment and a stronger economy, Cooper stated. During the time it takes us to get to a full renewable energy future, we will still need to rely on other fuels as we move away from the pollution of coal-fired power plants. And there's a companion article also written by Lauren K. Onosorge. Farmer on NCDEQ's Atlantic Coast Pipeline decision, we're all disappointed. While economic developers were celebrating Friday that state regulators had given the Atlantic Coast Pipeline permission to build in North Carolina, others, including Nash County farmer Marvin Winstead, are very, very disappointed. We're all disappointed, Winstead said minutes after the announcement. We feel like this is the wrong decision. We're disappointed at the lack of leadership from Governor Cooper. And he's hardly alone, as Senate Leader Phil Berger's office was hitting send on his statement celebrating the move. I appreciate Governor Cooper finally standing up to the far-left environmentalists, he stated. Environmental groups were crafting their own messages. The governor acted in the best interest of North Carolina's coastal families and businesses when he opposed offshore drilling, but his action today abandons the people who live and work in one of the most disenfranchised regions of our state and whose private property would be sacrificed for this unnecessary pipeline, Amy Adams, North Carolina program manager of Appalachian Voices, stated in an email. Winstead says groups were telling their members all week to brace for Friday's decision. We got a hint this was happening, he says. In response, he and his cohorts made dozens of phone calls. Just Thursday, he called Cooper's office to once again outline his position with his 2 cents worth. And just because regulators gave the project the go-ahead, he's not planning to stop. I read what Cooper said. I understand what he said, but we do not need natural gas as a transitional fuel, he says. Renewables are here now and can do the job. That's part of the campaign of misinformation. And he insists it's not over. Unfortunately, it's going to have to go through the courts now, he says. Winstead is among the property owners who has been targeted in eminent domain proceedings by ACP. According to court records, he is yet to receive his summons, he says. Before ACP can fully get started, it needs one more North Carolina erosion and sediment control permit, a federal water quality permit, and a Virginia erosion and sediment control permit. Once we receive those approvals, we'll take the final step of requesting a notice to proceed with full construction from FERC. ACP spokesman Aaron Ruby said in an email Friday, we expect that in time to begin full construction by early spring. NC customer advocate calls for $289 million rate cut at Duke Energy. And this article is written by John Downey with the Charlotte Business Journal. North Carolina's utility customer advocate has called on regulators to reject Duke Energy's Carolina's proposed 13.3% rate hike and instead cut rates 6.4%. That means a $289.3 million reduction in charges to customers. It would lower Duke's income from customers, called the annual revenue requirement, to about $4.22 billion from its current level of $4.5 billion. We took the same approach to this that we do to every case. We audit the costs and determine if they are reasonable and prudent and what is warranted, says Chris Ayers, executive director of the public staff of the NC Utilities Commission, charged with protecting the interest of utility customers in rate cases. Meredith Archie, a spokeswoman for parent Duke Energy Corporation, says the utility disagrees with the public staff's proposal, but she says the issue is for the NC Utilities Commission to decide. This is an expected and normal part of this transparent process of rate hearings, she says. We may disagree with some positions of the interveners in the case, the public staff and others, but we will be addressing all of that in our response file in the next few weeks. Revenue calculations. The commission will hold a hearing next month in Raleigh on Duke's proposed rate hike. If Duke's proposal is adopted, a typical residential customer's average bill would go up to somewhere more than $120 a month. The current average bill is about $104. The potential impact of the counter proposal by the public staff has not been calculated, but a typical residential bill could easily fall below $100 a month if the commission were to accept the staff's entire proposal. Regulators are free to accept or reject any part of the proposal made by the utility the public staff, and other interveners. While the public staff is often an influential voice in commission proceedings, the commission is not bound by its recommendations. Duke had initially called for more than $612 million in new revenue from a rate hike it proposed in August. This winter, Duke adjusted its proposal down to $598.7 million in additional annual revenue, about a 13.3% increase of current rates. The public staff says Duke's revenue needs don't justify an increase in rates. After dismissing costs they consider unreasonable or imprudent and adjusting the return Duke should expect to make on its investments, the public staff's technical and financial experts proposed cutting the annual revenue significantly. Steep cuts. The public staff calls for cutting about $210 million in revenue to reflect the lower taxes that Duke Carolinas will pay under the recently enacted federal income tax cut. It proposes slashing $190 million more from the annual revenue requirement by setting Duke's return on equity at 9.1% rather than the 10.75% Duke Carolinas proposed, as well as requiring that the capital structure be made up of 50% equity and 50% debt. Duke had proposed 53% equity and 47% debt. Reducing the amount of the equity in the business has the effect of reducing the revenue received from the allowed return on equity. The staff also recommends cutting about $113 million in annual revenue by requiring Duke to pay some of the costs for upgrading its coal ash disposal practices. Duke had wanted all of those costs to be carried by customers. The staff took the same approach to those coal ash costs as it did in Duke Energy Progress's proposed 10.8% rate hike. It calls for an equitable distribution of the coal ash costs between Duke Carolinas and its ratepayers. Lee Nuclear. The staff also called on the commission to reject Duke Carolinas' request that regulators build a run rate of $200 million in additional revenue requirement into rates to account for what Duke Carolinas expects to spend annually over the next several years on modernizing its ash operations. The staff had called on the commission to reject Duke Progress's request for including a run rate of more than $120 in annual revenue for that same purpose. And we'll stop there as the article goes on to mention that they also propose cutting any payments for Lee Nuclear Station planning that never came to fruition. But we'll go ahead and stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comment or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.